Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Radio Show. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice, our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. Oh, yes. Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is The Healthy Mind Podcast for November 14th, 2012. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program, especially today, November 14th, 2012. It is really just a couple days past, but the one-year anniversary of thehealthymind.com and the Healthy Mind podcast. I went live with the website at 11:11 a.m. on 11/11/11. So a very special thanks to all of you for listening to the podcast over the past year, joining me on the website, subscribing to the newsletter. I can't thank you enough. We've got 1 year under our belt, and we are blasting off into year two on The Healthy Mind. You are here on a great day. We're going to be talking today about stress and unexplained physical symptoms. Stress and unexplained physical symptoms. A couple of stories in the news this week, which really, for everything that I am trying to do on The Healthy Mind, you know that we talk about the role of our emotions in our health, but really this mind-body connection, how our emotions affect not only our psychological well-being, but the mind-body role that our emotions have in physical symptoms, particularly pain. And many of you know that I am part of a nonprofit organization known as the Psychophysiologic Disorders Association, the PPDA. And really, our main goal is trying to get out information and advocacy to let people know that our emotions matter. Psychology matters when it comes to physical illness, physical pain, and what many think are unexplained physical symptoms. So we're going to be talking about the role that our emotions and stress can have on the physical, particularly some of these unexplained medical symptoms. And I'll get into that in just a bit. I've got some great health news as well. You're going to want to stick around for the second half of the program, particularly if you have young children and daughters, the effect of stress on them from a very young age. So parents, stick around for the second half of the broadcast. You're going to want to hear this report. We're going to do the headlines, and heck, going into the second year of thehealthymind.com and the Healthy Mind podcast, we are going to be on fire. So I'm so glad that you are here. Don't forget, you can sign up for the monthly newsletter absolutely free. You can sign up for it there on the homepage. And any questions you may have, don't hesitate. I really love reading your emails, some beautiful emails that I've recently received. Peter@thehealthymind.com. Now, the effect of stress. We know that it is everywhere, and I have done many broadcasts and podcasts and stories on thehealthymind.com about the effect of stress, not only on our emotions, but also on our physical well-being. But there were a couple of stories in the news this week, health stories, one on heartburn and the other one on low back pain and specific sciatica, that were so important to me and what I do, and many of us who do this in the world of psychophysiologic disorders, that I decided to bag the topic for this week that I had already previously planned, because this was too important to not talk about. So I'm going to bring attention to a couple of those stories, and really where we have to start questioning some of these diagnoses, where they're coming from, and really moving towards considering psychological issues earlier in the whole process. Now, I'll explain this in detail as we move along here, but the first article, and I really encourage you to read both of these, but the first article was in the Wall Street Journal by one of the journal's health writers, Melinda Beck. And the title of the article is "Emerging Type of Heartburn Defies Drugs in Diagnosis." It's a beautifully written article, and it discusses heartburn or reflux and the fact that what we think we know about reflux, well, it might not be really accurate. They talk about the classic type of heartburn, GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease, and that is an acid issue. Acid burps up into your esophagus. It can cause pain and a lot of uncomfortable symptoms. You take different types of antacids or proton pump inhibitors like Nexium and the like, and the pain goes away. But the problem is, for many, many people, the pain doesn't go away when you give the medications. It doesn't go away. You load people with these proton pump inhibitors, very, very potent, yet the pain doesn't go away. Now, the gastroenterologists have dubbed this condition not GERD, but NERD, non-erosive reflux disease, meaning that the acid isn't the issue. It's not causing erosions in the esophagus which cause pain. You shoot a scope down there and there's no evidence of erosion or acid problems. Yet people have pain. They have pain. And really, the medical community can't really figure out what is going on. There's a lot of theories here, but no one really has a lock on this. And what's beautiful about it was that the president of the Psychophysiologic Disorders, Dr. David Clark, was interviewed for this particular article. And he talked about it because he, before being president of the Psychophysiologic Disorders Association, had been a gastroenterologist and treated thousands of patients. Those of you who are regular listeners to the podcast have heard my interview with Dr. Clark. If you haven't, I highly, highly encourage you to listen to the interview with Dr. David Clark, which is available to you anytime, absolutely free. I archive all the shows. Just click on the media tab on the homepage of thehealthymind.com. But he discusses the fact that in his experience, stress, emotions, were the reasons that people had pain. In fact, according to the article and what Dr. Clark says, he found that about a third of his patients didn't get better with proton pump inhibitors or other medications. And further on in the article, they said that the actual figure today may actually be higher than what Dr. Clark experienced in his practice. So what really is going on here? I mean, there are some competing theories, medical, physiologic, chemically based theories to explain maybe why people have pain. But as Dr. Clark noted that throughout his career, as he's talked in lectures around the world or on the podcast or on his own website, stressillness.com, psychological factors can be a large part of this, and that he oftentimes got relief for his patients simply by talking about their emotions and allowing them to release them. And this caused pain to go away. Now, we've talked about that here on The Healthy Mind, and I will continue because this is one of the main missions of The Healthy Mind, is to talk about the mind-body relationship, how our emotions affect us physically. And specifically, as it relates to my practice and interests, the role of emotions in physical pain. Emotions can create physical symptoms, especially pain. And we know that to be true. In fact, Dr. Howard Schubiner, who's also part of the Psychophysiologic Disorders Association and was gracious enough to be on an earlier podcast here on The Healthy Mind, talked about this and the scientific evidence that is out there confirming that our emotions, our thoughts do create physical symptoms. So I bring all of this up because We're talking about heartburn, one of the most common physical ailments in contemporary American society. It's really just part of our culture. And yet, when we talk about traditional theories, reflux, acid, causing this, it doesn't pan out. Well, not for a lot of people. Acid burping up into our esophagus, causing pain, doesn't seem to be the reason why a lot of these people are in pain. So what is it? And I don't claim to have the answer, the perfect answer. But what's important here is that the mindset, the thinking, the meme has to change so that doctors and treaters consider the psychological explanations as a possibility early on in the treatment and early on in the consideration of what to do. The psychological factors and their ability to create physical symptoms shouldn't be the last thing you think of when nothing else makes sense. We've ruled everything else out. There's nothing to explain this, so it must be in your mind. We can't do that because there's too much evidence to suggest that psychological factors themselves may be the reason why people are in pain. So what we try to do, in addition to the treatment that all of us do, is to advocate for that, to say, look, listen, whether you're a doctor, a nurse, a patient, talk about the psychological issues early on in the treatment. Because you see stories like this all the time. These physical symptoms that can't be explained. Despite all of the advances that we have in modern medicine and Western medicine, we still can't figure out for millions of people in our country why they are in pain and also what to do about it. And on top of that, despite mounds of data showing the impact of psychological factors on health and illness, psychological explanations for why people could actually have physical pain and other physical symptoms is either marginalized, totally rejected, or completely ignored. People who have tried and have made a difference in the lives of millions of people are called quacks. They're ridiculed by those in Western medicine. Even though the data shows, no matter what you look at, this article on heartburn or the other story that I'll tell you about with regards to sciatica or some of the most common findings on MRI that it turns out people with no pain will have, no one wants to look at the psychological factors or those that are saying, well, wait a minute, I've got scores of patients or hundreds of patients or thousands of patients that are getting better or have gotten better. We've got to change that dialogue. We've got to allow for psychological factors to be part of the initial workup in patients who are suffering from pain and other physical discomfort. Not because they're going to explain everything, but there's enough evidence, more than enough evidence, to suggest that psychological factors may be driving the problems for many, many patients. Now, here's another story. This was a really amazing week. This from the Annals of Internal Medicine, and I have to thank Dr. Howard Schubner for bringing this to our attention. The headline, steroid injections do not provide long-term relief to back pain. Steroid injections don't provide long-term relief. And there's been a lot of recent news about steroid injections with some of the contaminated steroid compounds from that New England dispensary. But here, think about that. Injections do not provide long-term relief to back pain. How many people are getting injections for their back pain? Now, to be totally accurate and fair, what was studied was epidural steroid injections and their relationship to relief. And they found that it was only short-term relief from a low back pain condition known as sciatica. Now, what is sciatica, you say? You've heard it, but maybe you're not sure exactly what it is. But it's low back pain, and you'll get pain into the leg. There can be numbness and tingling, but it's that shooting pain that can radiate all the way down your leg. Very, very painful, very, very disabling. It's found that patients with sciatica are almost four times more likely to have back surgery for that particular condition. But what exactly is it? These epidural steroids, even though you think you know where you're going to relieve the pain, only offer short-term relief. This is what the studies found. Short-term, they may work for a little bit of time, but long-term, whether you did nothing or whether you did the injections, there was no difference in the outcome for these patients. So the question is, what's going on here? What is going on here? We think we know what we're talking about when we talk about all these pain syndromes, back pain and the like. And really, a lot of back surgery has been done, but you know, if you look at the long-term data, doing back surgery versus conservative treatment, not a whole lot of difference. So the question is, what are we doing? We're injecting people. Maybe they're not getting better, or they don't get better at all. Surgery, maybe not a whole lot of difference from being conservative. But why and where is this back pain coming from? How can it be that some people can have terrible, terrible looking backs by MRI or CAT scan, terrible looking backs, vertebrae that have shifted, blown discs, nerves that are being pressed, yet they have no pain at all? The studies have been done to verify this. Yet someone by an MRI, you can't find an abnormality. Their back is pristine, yet they're in excruciating pain. What is going on here? And I don't claim to have all the answers or a grand unifying theory on pain. And none of us in the PPDA claim to have all the answers. But we can't push off the psychological factors as if they are not relevant, as if psychological interventions might not be as effective and, dare I say, perhaps more effective than the physical treatments themselves. I'm not trying to play a game of one-upsmanship here at all, but we can't push off the psychological explanations as if that's the last thing that we think of. It could avoid surgeries. It could avoid injections. If we just talk about these, they're just emotions. They're just thoughts. And I have seen people get better when the emotional aspects of their lives, of their physical symptoms, are addressed and discussed. And this isn't about me. Literally millions have been helped. Whether it's the work of Dr. John Sarno, or the work of Dr. David Schechter, or Dr. David Clark, who was quoted in the Wall Street Journal article, Dr. Howard Schubiner, Alan Gordon, and many, many others who are devoting their lives to mind-body medicine and daring to challenge the status quo, not because they have to prove to the world that they're right, but to say, wait a minute, what about the psychological factors? Include them, and include them early on. Because the truth is, we don't have all the answers. And that shouldn't scare people. It shouldn't make them feel threatened. It's really what motivates all of us to go out and figure out what's going on. That's all. We have to involve the psychological explanations as part of the initial treatment and present that to the patients that we treat. Not because I'm a psychiatrist, but because they matter. They're relevant. Science is showing that. And what we do, well, maybe that's just that many more people that we help so that they're not suffering and in pain. And that, my friends, would be a great step to take overall for healthcare, and would be a great step to take down our road to the healthy mind. And now, it's time for news. Okay, well, another very, very busy week of health news. And this first story, parents, especially if you have daughters, listen up. The headline, Family Stress may sensitize infant girls' brains for later anxiety. This was a pretty amazing study here talking about the long-term effects of stress going back as early as infancy as it relates to the health and well-being of girls. It turns out that high levels of family stress in infancy are linked to differences in everyday brain function and anxiety in teenage girls. And this was a result of a fairly long-term study that came out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And what this particular study highlighted was really the evidence of a kind of a developmental pathway through which early stress in life may drive these changes in the brains of these girls. Now, what they found was that babies who lived in homes with stressed mothers were much more likely to grow into preschoolers who had higher levels of cortisol. And we've talked about this before on The Healthy Mind, the stress hormone. And what they also found in addition to this was that there was less communication between key areas of the brain that were associated with emotional regulation. And the amazing part was that these high cortisol differences and the differences in brain activity predicted higher levels of anxiety in these girls when they were 18 years of age. Unbelievable. And just as interesting, the young men in the study didn't show any of these patterns. This was isolated to girls. According to the lead author, Dr. Corey Berge, quote, "We wanted to understand how stress in life impacts patterns of brain development, which might lead to anxiety and depression. Young girls who as preschoolers had heightened cortisol levels go on to show lower brain connectivity in important nerve pathways for emotional regulation, and that predicts symptoms of anxiety during adolescence." What they did was MRI scans on these girls. And again, the mothers who reported high stress showed reduced connections, these girls did, between the areas of the brain known as the amygdala, which is the threat center of the brain, and the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that's responsible for regulating negative emotion. And near the time of the scan, the scientists asked the teenagers about their anxiety symptoms and about the stress in their lives at that moment. And what they found was a connection with childhood stress, not current stress levels. And this is where it led them to believe that higher cortisol levels in childhood could have modified the girl's developing brain. According to Dr. Richard Davidson, one of the professors of psychology there, quote, "This will pave the way to better understanding of how the brain develops and could give us insights into the ways to intervene when children are young." Stress, early on in life, what some people call adverse childhood experiences, matter. That stress can have profound implications, not just in the moment, not even a few years down the line, but as far as 18 years of age and beyond as it relates to anxiety disorders. Just amazing mind-body research done at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Okay, well, I thought this story was just kind of a fun story on human behavior. The headline, "Why Our Performance Improves After Receiving a Compliment." And this was research that came out of Japan, but a team of Japanese scientists have found scientific proof that people doing exercise appear to perform better. We just do better when somebody compliments us. Now, this same research team had previously discovered that the very same area of the brain, the striatum, is activated when a person is rewarded a compliment or is given, say, something like cash. And their latest research could suggest that when that part of the brain, the striatum, is activated, it really seems to encourage people to perform better during exercises. They did the studies and they consistently found that when people were complimented, they did better at the tasks in the study. It was a specific finger exercise. Now, according to Professor Sidotta, one of the lead researchers, quote, to the brain, receiving a compliment is as much a social reward as being rewarded money. We've been able to find scientific proof that a person performs better when they receive a social reward after completing an exercise. Complimenting someone could become an easy and effective strategy to use in the classroom and in rehabilitation. End of quotes. Complimenting. How about that? Compliment those that you care about and that you love. Beyond it making them feel better, heck, it could improve their overall performance in everything that they're doing. Okay, with the time that we have left, I just want to blast through the rest of the news in a segment I like to call the Healthy Mind Headlines. Okay, the first headline, and it's a big one with regards to Alzheimer's. The headline, gene nearly triples the risk of Alzheimer's. A gene so powerful it nearly triples the risk of Alzheimer's disease has been discovered by an international team, including researchers from Mayo Clinic. It is the most potent genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's disease identified in the past 20 years. Wow. The next headline. Exposure to light at night may cause depression and learning issues. Exposures to too much bright light in the evenings may elevate the risk of both depression and learning issues. This, according to the latest research from Johns Hopkins University. And finally, the headline, exploring the financial costs of sadness. Your emotions can certainly impact your decisions, but you might be surprised by the extent to which your emotions affect your pocketbook. New research published in Psychological Science explores how impatience brought on by sadness can in turn produce substantial financial loss. Your emotions and sadness, the costs are huge. And now, new data on the financial costs. Wow. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have done it again. You and I, we have made it to the end of yet another broadcast of The Healthy Mind, the very first one in The Healthy Mind's second year. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to today's podcast and all the podcasts over the last year. I really do appreciate it. Thank you so much. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. You can follow me on Twitter. Don't forget to sign up for the free monthly newsletter right there on the homepage. And any questions, comments, anything, I want to hear from you. Don't hesitate to email me, the email address, peter@thehealthymind.com. That's peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on the Healthy Mind.